Hi guys, welcome to History and Game. Charles Dickens is one of the most recognizable and significant writers of the Victorian era. With long-standing classics such as Oliver Twist, Bleak House, and A Christmas Carol under his belt, Dickens decides to open his 17th novel, A Tale of Two Cities, with the following sentence. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Picture a little girl, if you will, all alone on the playground, swinging smoothly and effortlessly back and forth, swinging all the way forward, catching a glimpse of the neighborhood beyond her playground. It was the best of times. And then all the way back, the hard and harsh ground filling her vision, so close, so immediate, so threatening. It was the worst of times. That right there, that's life. Sure, you can choose not to swing at all, and some have, but to indulge in the joys of life, you must endure the swings. In 2009, what kids are now referring to as back in the day, I found myself in a backswing. It was the worst of times. A few years prior, my long-term relationship fell apart in what I can only describe as a breakup worthy of Jerry Springer. For a year, I'm tossed around in the black, windowless, bouncy castle of life, drinking too much, struggling to hold on to a job, and falling behind in my bills. Well, one night, I'm quite ossified drunk. It's 3 a.m., I decide to sit at the computer and write a letter to a woman I had not seen nor heard from in just a few hairs shy of a decade. A woman I met during my first failed attempt at college. And yeah, you heard me right, my first failed attempt. Not long after meeting her, she starts dating my best friend. We hang out as a group with me as the perennial third wheel, of course, but I start to see less and less of them. Eventually, they relocate to a bigger city a few hours away, and as way leads on to way, I lose complete contact. However, for reasons unknown, she always stuck with me, tucked away in the back of my mind, rent-free. Back at my computer at 3 a.m., I write her a letter. Through the powers of social media, I am privy to the knowledge that she and my former friend are no longer together and have not been for a few years. I don't know why I chose that night to write her a letter, but akin to every other drunken story, it seemed like a good idea at the time. I'm completely out of it, but my fingers keep typing. I describe everything previously mentioned, meeting her, my immediate fondness for her, watching her date my friend, move away, and that despite not seeing her for many, many years, she's never strayed too far from my thoughts. Well, a few days pass, and boy howdy, my shame and embarrassment are enough to stink a dog off a gut wagon, because we all know blatant and overt proclamations of love rarely work, let alone sloppy, drunken ones. According to the Dobler-Dahmer theory, which shouldn't be a theory at all because it's absolutely 100% a real thing, seriously don't at me. If both people are into each other, then a big romantic gesture works, like Lloyd Dobler and the boombox at the end of Say Anything. But if one person isn't into the other, the same gesture comes off serial killer crazy, like Jeffrey Dahmer. But then I receive a reply. She's flattered, and is also interested in me. Huh. Forget Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster. Riddle me how that happened, Batman. She struggles with numerous long-term and serious health conditions such as chronic migraines, fatigue, pain, and fibromyalgia. These conditions are intense and beyond her control. I knew of her struggle from day one. I knew what I was getting myself into. Unfortunately, and I place no ill will on this woman, I want that to be clear, but her health conditions become a significant factor in our relationship. Being either too tired to go out like normal 20-somethings, or too medicated to stay active on a consistent basis, I reached an important relationship moment. We needed something fresh that we could do together without having to be socially active, let's say, you know, around loud music in a crowded environment. Like many out there who know of someone who suffers from serious health issues, you know that there are good days, the best of times, and there are bad days, the worst of times. I had reached a point where I needed something to minimize our bad days and maximize our good ones. I needed to min-max our relationship. Looking back, if I only would have kept a diary, journal, captain's log, whatever, something, then this part of the story wouldn't be missing. But truth be told, I have spent years racking my brain, dusting off the cobwebs, trying to shake free how or what led me to board games. But sadly, I have no answer for you. The first vivid memory I have is watching a YouTube video series where the hosts taught, in fine detail, I might add, every rule, every phase, every card, every possible action to a game called Arkham Horror. After a week of watching, trying to grasp the complicated rules, every game was complicated to me back then, I hopped on eBay and ordered a used copy of Arkham Horror, the board game. My girlfriend and I took to the game like a moth to a flame. We played for days and days. I was flabbergasted. We played the rusty bucket out of that thing. Every game brought us closer together. Arkham Horror was a godsend. Eventually, we left each other to go our own ways, but my love for playing board games remained. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Okay, let's examine my story one more time. I got dumped, which led to being drunk, which led to a random love letter, which led to a relationship with a woman I hadn't seen in years, like a damn Nicholas Sparks novel, which then led to my infatuation with board games. The me that gets dumped on step one is not the same me that loves board games on step six. However, without being dumped, one could argue that I never would have fallen in love with board games. In fact, I wouldn't even be sitting right here recording this podcast. I'd be somebody completely different, bizarro Andrew. Examining the causality of events is known as historical determinism. At its core, historical determinism argues the idea that everything that happens is fully fixed by what has gone before it. So, in short, everything that happens is correlated to something else that has happened. In our lives, each and every encounter is another variable, another direction. If you widen the lens, who we are, where we've come from, and where we're going is like a river, never ending, stretching from horizon to horizon. I began my story with being dumped, but what about everything that happened before that? And everything before that. And before that? Now, I'm not getting up on my soapbox advocating that we're all dominated by our past, because I swore off trying to kickstart that dead horse long ago. What I am advocating is that while our past experiences, the good, the bad, and the ugly, push and pull on our psychological mold, the good news is that we have a say. We still have a choice in the ever-passing moment of life. How do you react to being dumped or losing a job or getting into a fender bender? What will your choice be? It may be far more important than you think, so make it a good one. In history, historical determinism establishes a river that stretches from the dawn of time to the last minute on your watch. Yeah, a supermassively long river. Recently, I was listening to What We Saw, The Cold War, a podcast narrated by Bill Whittle. First off, the podcast, absolutely stellar. 5 stars. I can't recommend it enough. The guy's got a voice I could listen to for hours. In one episode, Mr. Whittle describes the ambiguity surrounding when the Cold War officially started. Apparently, there's quite a bit of contention within the historical community. With historical determinism on the brain, I found myself swimming down the river of history. If everything is related, connected, like a circle, then when does a circle start? The Cold War started in 1917. Vladimir Lenin, a young political activist, writes and publishes One Step Forward, Two Steps Back, The Crisis in Our Party, a propaganda pamphlet defending the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. Lenin's writing promulgates civil war and the formation of a new political faction known as the Bolshevik Party. Now, in October, Lenin starts a revolution. The Bolsheviks orchestrate a military coup and overthrow the provincial government. First, as the newly appointed head honcho, Lenin immediately withdraws Russian troops from the Great War. A smooth move, considering Russia's involvement in the conflict led to economic and social turmoil. Then, he decides to rename the entire damn country of Russia to the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, or the USSR. And finally, using his long-standing Marxist ideologies, Lenin reconstructs a new form of government called communism. The Cold War started in 1848. Karl Marx, a German philosopher, writes the Communist Manifesto. The manifesto seeks to explain the values and political plans of communism. The manifesto claims that society had simplified into two classes in direct conflict, the bourgeoisie, which is the capital-owning class, and the proletariat, the working class. Marx and others, by the way, believes that the bourgeoisie had substituted equality for brutal exploitation. Elements of life that had once protected people's freedom had been cast aside for one unconscionable freedom, known as free trade. The only solution, according to Marx, was for all the instruments of economic production to become common property, so that every member of society could work according to their capacities and consume according to their needs. This was the only way to prevent the rich from living at the expense of the poor. The Cold War started in 1948. With Western Europe in ruins, George C. Marshall, the U.S. Secretary of State, goes on record saying that, quote, "The United States should do whatever it is able to do to assist in the return of the normal economic health in the world, without which there can be no political stability and no assured peace," unquote. Tensions between the two nations begin as America demonizes communist countries. Marshall drafts and enacts the Marshall Plan, providing $15 billion of financial aid to West Germany, France, and the UK, earmarked for the rebuilding of cities, industry networks, and infrastructure. Every European country is invited to participate, but the Marshall Plan has one condition for receiving aid: the holding of free and fair elections. George C. Marshall and America's message to communist-occupied Europe was very clear. And no soup for you! The Marshall Plan sends tension between the US and the USSR catapulting into hardcore mode. The Cold War started in 1962. Soviet First Secretary Nikita Khrushchev deploys intermediate-range ballistic missiles, or MRBMs, to communist Cuba to bolster his ally from American aggression. President John F. Kennedy's military advisors demand for an immediate attack on Cuba's missile sites, but Kennedy favored a naval blockade of Cuba to prevent the installation of more missiles. He issues an ultimatum to Khrushchev to withdraw and inform the world that nuclear war was an immediate, imminent possibility. However, Khrushchev, he won't budge. He orders Soviet ships to hold their course for Cuban ports. In a photo finish, Kennedy agrees to remove missiles from Turkey if Khrushchev dismantles all nuclear weapons in Cuba. A deal is made moments before the buzzer, where eyeball to eyeball, and I think the other fellow just blinked. The Cold War started in 1957. Sputnik 1, a USSR radio transmitter satellite, becomes the world's first artificial satellite successfully launched into space. Sputnik symbolizes more than a scientific breakthrough. It establishes the USSR as a superpower, initiating a frantic competition between nations for technological superiority known as the Space Race. The Cold War ended in 1989. President Ronald Reagan, a former movie star, delivers a speech in front of the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin. Despite opposition from his top advisors, Reagan issues a bold demand. General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate, Mr. Gorbachev. Open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Aiming for somewhat warmer relations with the West, Gorbachev lifts the ban on Eastern countries and reforms their political systems. The fall of the Berlin Wall is a momentous event. It marks an era that saw the end of the Cold War and the dissolution of the Soviet Union. The world changed in 1989. Communism was dead in the East, and after 44 years, Germany is reunified, allowing millions to work, travel, reunite with family, and live free. If Seven Wonders Duel is relaxing in a hotel pool, then Twilight Struggle is like a day at the water park. Originally published in 2005 by GMT Games, Twilight Struggle is an asymmetrical two-player area control strategy game for ages 14 and up, with a game time lasting anywhere from a couple of hours to the second coming of Christ. Seriously, in one play session of Twilight Struggle, our game lasted so long that by the time it was all said and done, I had magically grown a beard. No fooling. In Season 2, Episode 5, The Elephant and the Donkey, I discuss Twilight Struggle's newer and bigger brother, 1960, The Making of the President. While both games are asymmetrical two-player area control games, based on my experience, The Making of the President remains the heavyweight champion of the two-player world. However, that's not to say Twilight Struggle is like boxing a feather either. Don't worry, I promise. There's still plenty of struggle to go around. In Twilight Struggle, players assume the role of either the United States or the USSR. The object of the game is to score victory points by controlling countries or resolving certain event cards. The game is over in one of four ways. 1. If a player ever reaches 20 victory points, the game ends immediately and they are declared the winner. 2. If the Europe scoring card is played and a player controls Europe, the game ends immediately and the controlling player is declared the winner. 3. If the DEFCON track, for whatever reason, reaches 1 during a player's turn, the opposing player is automatically declared the winner. 4. At the end of turn 10, every region is scored and added to the current victory point score. After scoring every region, the player with the most victory points is declared the winner. Okay, listen. Every round of Twilight Struggle is broken down into 6 phases, with a ton of options and things to do within each phase. The game is a beast. I'm going to mention a few things I love about Twilight Struggle and call it a day. This approach is not even in the same ballpark as a rules explanation, but my goal for the upcoming minutes is to pique your interest just enough for you to hop on the Google machine and search up a video or two. Okay, Andrew, remember to breathe and just try to have fun with it. Let's start with something I love that's easy to describe. Throughout the game, players draw from a tiered deck of cards. Early, mid, and late war cards are shuffled independently and stacked with, you know, the late war cards on the bottom, mid war in the middle, and early war on top. Since cards represent historical events, a tiered deck not only controls the release of particular card powers, but replicates a timeline of Cold War events. The utilization of a simple tiered mechanism hits the game right square in the theme, and I am a sucker for theme. While on the subject of cards, another thing I love about Twilight Struggle is its implementation of card versatility. Every card represents a smorgasbord of engaging and meaningful opportunities. Cards may be played as either events or operations. Events are pretty straightforward, but the real nuts and bolts are operations. Instead of using the event, every card provides operation points that the players may spend to place influence markers on the board, reduce your opponent's influence by triggering realignment rolls, convert your opponent's influence by attempting a coup, or advancing your faction on the space racetrack. While realignment rolls and coups can be a drag to resolve, driving the game to a screeching halt as players are often forced to consult charts, performing math, or both, they do scratch my deviant itch. Also, before moving on, knowing when to play a card for its event ability or for the operation points gives the game some real teeth. As previously mentioned, the primary goal of the game is to collect 20 victory points. Doesn't sound too bad, eh? However, the victory point track is a tug of war between the players. Instead of scoring independently, players feel like they are literally fighting over power. The marker starts on 0. If I am the USSR player and gain 10 points, the marker moves to 10 on the red side. If the United States player scores 5 points, the marker moves down to 5, but is still on the USSR side. Again, it's a stupidly primitive idea that's been done to death, but for this game, holy Moses, it really works. And just when you think I couldn't get any more subjective, bam, I've saved the best for last. Hello, my name is Andrew Davidson, and I am a space race junkie. I listened to the entirety of Bill Whittle's Apollo 11 podcast in under a day. I've watched the HBO miniseries From the Earth to the Moon numerous times. I watch Ron Howard's movie Apollo 13 at least once a year. My little robot vacuum has an Apollo 11 sticker on it, NASA t-shirts in the closet, Apollo and Gemini buttons on my travel bag. Yeah, in for a penny, in for a pound. In Twilight Struggle, players may advance along the space racetrack. Now, you may remember a lack of love for the space racetrack during the game's win conditions. And it's true. There is absolutely no way, no chance, no ma'am, no how to win the game by focusing on the space race. Boo freaking who. However, special abilities are granted to the first player to reach the corresponding spot on the track. These special abilities allow you to discard your hand and draw a new one, play a card after seeing your opponent's card, or play an additional card per turn. So, while the space race won't win you the game, per se, it augments your playstyle abilities in huge ways. I'm talking like James and the Giant Peach huge. These special abilities create a distinct, disproportional advantage over your opponent. I love it. Go space race! And finally, even though I love the game, Twilight Struggle comes with an enormous caveat. The game fits snugly in an anorexic thin category of games you purchase that are not cheap, not easy to learn, and not easy to get to the table more than once every few years. In life, we are all on the playground, swinging back and forth. By playing Twilight Struggle, we learn to appreciate the back and forth, the best of times and the worst of times, because, after all, who knows where the river will take you? My name is Andrew Davidson. I hope I have given you something to think about.